Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and it's always entertaining when Alejandro Mayorkas is before a congressional committee, and it was again yesterday, Mayorkas testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And, of course, there's no shortage of things to talk about when it pertains to Homeland Security, particularly border security, as well as security policy with respect to refugees, say, for example, refugees from Afghanistan being resettled in the United States. And so a lot of topics to cover. Starting sort of baseline here, the question as to whether what kind of grade Mayorkas gives himself. How are things going this administration as compared to the last? That was Lindsey Graham's line of questioning.
Let's just pull back a little bit and just ask some basic questions. Do you believe the Biden immigration policies are successful?
Senator, I think rebuilding a broken immigration system and rebuilding a dismantled one takes time, and we're on the road to success.
So you think we're on the right track as a nation?
I do.
Okay. How would you grade yourself?
Senator, I'm a tough grader on myself, and I give myself an A for effort, investment, okay, in mission, and support of our workforce.
Okay. Do you think you're doing a better job than the Trump administration?
Senator, I believe in the policies that we are putting forward, and I condemn a number of the policies that were promulgated in the prior administration.
So you think we have more control over the border now than we did under Trump?
Senator, we're very focused on the
number. That's not the question. Do you think we have more control over the border now than we did under the last administration?
I think we have more control that is consistent with our values as a nation.
Okay.
I'll tell you, I appreciate that he's operating under the new grading system in America, A for effort, not actually performance-based. Mayorkas, in terms of his self-grading, an A. Well, that's interesting against the backdrop of the questioning he endured from Senator Ted Cruz, because Cruz started with just sort of
awesome,
trying to take a stop, look, and listen on the numbers, where we're at right now. So just keep in the back of your mind the A for effort and the administration being more successful in controlling the border consistent with our values. Okay. All right. Well, let's bump that up against some of these metrics.
This year, under Joe Biden, we've seen the highest rate of illegal immigration in 61 years.
Again, I don't know the number of years, but it's certainly a historic high, Senator.
So you're right, it's broken, but you broke it. Let me ask you, in the calendar year 2021, how many illegal immigrants do you expect to have crossed illegally into the United States?
I believe the total number of encounters, as has been referenced in this hearing earlier, is approximately just under 1.7 million.
But there's 2 months remaining. Is it correct that you project over 2 million illegal immigrants in 2021, calendar year 2021?
I believe that is correct, Senator. And over the last 3 months, we've seen a drop in the numbers by reason.
And how many children do you project in 2021?
I'm sorry?
How many children will have crossed illegally in 2021?
I believe that thus far through October 31st, Senator, approximately 125,000 unaccompanied children have been transferred to the shelter and care of Health and Human Services.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to put one on a T for you since it's only 5:20 in the morning. Does that sound like an A for effort to you? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro, text line. A for an effort, A for border control, consistent with our values. Projected 2 million people will be apprehended at the border this year.
Oh, yeah. And how many of them have to have vaccinations? Mm-hmm. For different people.
Well, that was another question that among many that was put by Ted Cruz to Alejandro Mayorkas, and for which he had no answer. He's going to have to, Jen Psaki, circle back on that.
Who were COVID positive?
Senator, it is our policy to test individuals.
I didn't ask your policy. How many illegal aliens have you released who were COVID positive?
Well, let me just say, when they are released, they are placed in immigration.
How many have you released that were COVID positive?
Ted Cruz.
I will have to get that number.
Okay, you don't have that answer either. All right, let's.
Mm-hmm. No answers on that. No answers on the number of criminals released into the country.
Murderers,
no answers.
Rapists.
Yeah, and right to the category of Class X felonies. Oh, he went right down the line. We don't know. He'll have to circle back on all of those matters. And then there was this. This fun exchange between Cruz and Mayorkas about Biden's cages. When, you know, remember when Cruz spoke at our Freedom Summit the other weekend, he talked about, you know, the Biden cages that he's been to border detention facilities, and he sees kids in cages, just like in the previous administration, just like in the administration before that. So going back to Obama, since it was Obama era policy. And so, you know, if you want to demagogue the problems at the border and do so while you're sort of less than subtly pursuing open border policy, well, then let's apply the same outrage that was generated during the Trump administration to the Biden administration. Mayorkas doesn't like the term cages, of course not. But unfortunately for him, Ted Cruz had pictures.
How many children have been in the Biden cages in calendar year 2021?
Senator, I respectfully disagree with your use of the term cages.
Fine, you can disagree with it. How many children have been in the Biden cages? I've been to the Biden cages. I've seen the Biden cages. How many children have you detained at the Donna Tent facility in the cages you built to hold kids? How many children have been in those cages?
Senator, I can provide to you the following figure that when a child.
It's a simple question. How many children have been in those cages?
I respectfully am not familiar with the term cages and to what you are referring.
There are enclosures in which they are locked in which I took photographs and put them out because you blocked the press and didn't want people to see the Biden cages. The secure facilities in which they are locked down in Donna, those facilities, how many children have been in them?
Senator, there are three types of facilities. There's
the Donna Tent cages, the Donna Tent City. Let's take the Donna facility. How many children have been there?
That is a soft-sided facility. It is not a.
Okay, are you going to answer the question? How many children have been in that facility?
I will have to circle back with you with a precise number.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, by the way, here's a photograph of the Biden cages.
His assistant got it to him.
Senator, that is precisely why I articulated.
Children sleeping on floors, crashed in upon each other. When I took this photograph, the COVID rate of COVID positivity was over 10%.
May I speak, Senator?
You can answer the question. How many kids have been in these conditions?
That is precisely why I stated in March of this year that a Border Patrol station is no place for a child, number one.
Okay, but
number two,
all right. Secretary Mayorkas, you're not answering my questions.
A Border Patrol facility is no place for children. Well, they're right there. They're sleeping in the cage. That's an enclosure
door and a lock on it.
Right. What is a cage? It's a wonderful metaphysical question. You remind me of like Jacobs from Airplane and the plane. What is it? Well, it's a tubular object with wings, got drapes, looks like a flying Tylenol. Yeah, exactly. What is a cage? I'm not familiar with that term. That's a terrible thing when that happens. Well, it's happening. Here's a picture from my time at the facility that Ted Cruz mentioned at the border. It's just remarkable. The one more exchange between one of the GOP senators on Senate Judiciary and Mayorkas, because it's germane, since we still don't have a resolution to this, even though it was, I believe, supposed to take a week or so. That independent investigation into those Border Patrol agents who were wrongly accused, horse-bound Border Patrol agents.
Oh, right, yeah, with the whipping, the Haitians, yeah.
Wrongly accused of whipping Haitian migrants.
Which, by the way, Jen Psaki said would be, you know, the investigation would be complete in a week. And now where are we? Months later and nothing.
Right, and so Mike Lee pursued that issue with Mayorkas. and properly asked him. If you remember, Mayorkas played Pontius Pilate on the issue. He did not rally to the defense of Border Patrol, even when it was obvious, including from eyewitness testimony, that what was being characterized was wholly inaccurate. Here's Mike Lee on Mayorkas.
What about the issue with your Border Patrol agents recently being accused by some folks in the media of whipping illegal immigrants, when in fact they were not? Why on earth did you not defend them? I mean, has no one in your entire department ever become aware of how one uses split reins when riding a horse?
Oh, Senator, let me say two things. Number one, I put 100% into my work, and I'm incredibly proud to do so. That's number one. Number two, I stand with the men and women of our department through and through, and I will not prejudge facts before.
Did you defend them when they were being attacked for whipping people, which they were not?
Senator, what I said quite clearly is that the independent investigation will determine the facts, and those facts will drive the outcome.
Okay.
Nothing less and nothing more.
Your response and your failure to defend them then and now is nothing short of morale crushing. If you want to maintain or obtain operational control of the border, which you do not now have, this is not a way to get there.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Bill and Glen Ellen.
Yeah, I think that you're judging the Mayorkas by a different set of standards than should be applied, because the A for effort, his effort is to get more and more illegals across the border as fast as possible in the next 4 years. And according to that standard, he's doing a bang-up job. So I'm not sure why everyone's condemning him. I mean, sure, if you want a normal standard, he sucks. But according to the Democrat standards, I mean, he should get a...
Thanks for the call, Bill. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Project Veritas is undercover again. They've got a whistleblower. They've got a whistleblower named Brett Mauser. And this is about how media operates. And perhaps some of this won't be a surprise. Perhaps some of this will be reminiscent of the corporate environment or business environment in which you work. Whistleblower Brett Mauser, he's a former promotions producer at CBS affiliate in San Antonio. It's one of some 64 stations in 51 markets owned by a company called Tegna. And the thrust here is the education that is being imposed upon the on-air talent as well as the newsroom, so the production staff as well, in terms of the perspective that needs to be brought to the news that is delivered. Now, I don't know if anybody listening watches network affiliate news anymore other than my co-host. But
I was going to be the co-anchor in Ken's TV, the CBS affiliate in San Antonio. It's a great station down there. They've always been a powerhouse.
I don't even know what that means, a powerhouse. Do they do good stories or not?
They do great investigations. Or they did in the 90s. I don't know. I haven't watched them since I've moved out of Texas. But they were. But they're always had a right, you know, they're right.
I don't know why
station.
Anybody would watch network affiliate news, number one, because it's just the same old slant that you get from the press corps writ large. Number two, it has no relevance to your life. It's crack ups on expressways, residential kitchen fires, the violent crime du jour, cross promotion for network programming, and stale weather and sports. What's to watch?
You love the stale weather in sports scores, which is true.
True.
It's so true.
I mean, it's completely true.
Yeah.
So
but sometimes they do good stories. But anyway, let's see what happens.
Here's an example of the attitude that you're dealing with. Some of the on-air talent, some of the anchors are way ahead of the die instructors. Ron Trevino is an anchor at Houston station owned by Tegna. This is a rather interesting statement to hear from a news reader, news deliverer.
I don't really care if people trust us or not. You still got to do your job. So, I mean, that's the least of my concerns, whether they trust me or not.
It seems like an odd position to take. The least of my concern, if I'm an on-air person, if I'm a communicator of information, is I don't care whether the people listening or watching trust me. Well, if they don't trust you, they're probably not going to be listening or watching for very long. And to the extent they listen or watch, they're listening or watching you as a sideshow. So I'm glad that Ron Trevino cares not about what people think about him in terms of his trustworthiness, but I suppose that speaks to the focus here, which is not serving the people listening or watching, serving my corporate overlords who say I have to hew the line as it pertains to this particular political orthodoxy.
You want listeners and viewers to trust you.
Wasn't Walter Cronkite like the most trusted man in America?
Yeah, that's right.
That was value. That was something that was coveted to be trusted to deliver information. Not so much anymore. But I think about what Ron Trevino is saying. The people watching and listening, I mean the hoi polloi out there in San Antonio or in the greater Houston area, they're not my audience. My audience is the leftists who run the station, who run the corporation, who run the country. That's my audience. That's who I'm here to serve. I think it's an interesting admission. Here's an example of what's happening system-wide in these Tegna-owned stations. Again, 64 stations in 51 markets that they say represent about 40% of the television news-watching population in America. That's the reach they have. Their chief diversity officer is a guy named Grady Tripp. And here's what he recently said during a, again, system-wide training session.
It's kind of sorry, not sorry for the statement that I'm making there. At this point, if you're not listening to a podcast or looking at a video or reading any of the information that's out as far as equality and social justice and race, you don't care. Now, I don't know how else to say it because it's there. We're going to be holding stations accountable because we know it's important to the organization. KPIs are going to change, right? KPIs are going to reflect diversity and inclusion from a representation standpoint at various levels.
KPIs are going to change, KPIs, key performance indicators. So it's not going to be based on like market share, audience, ad revenue. It's going to be based on what we're putting out there because we're here to serve ourselves. We're not here to serve our audience. Representation, you know, chief diversity officer.
Yeah.
Although I got to say, is that something that's really that new in the newsroom?
No, that's been going on since the beginning of time.
What's been going on since the beginning of time?
Representation? What are you asking me?
You react to Grady Tripp. Has that been going on since you were in the newsrooms at NBC5?
Yes, in Detroit, in El Paso, everywhere. Yes.
Well, what were the conversations?
Well, about that you have to include everybody in the community. You have to do stories. You can't just do stories on one certain group in the community. You have to represent the entire community.
I don't think that's what he's saying. I think he's talking about key performance indicators inside the station, not the news product. Yeah, the news product. What I'm asking is this new what he's talking about, which is representation. That's inside. That's representation in terms of what does the composition of the newsroom look like? What does the composition of the production staff look like? What does the composition of our on-air talent look like? Do we have, you know, the proper number of mascots covering all of the identitarian cross-sectional categories?
Yes, that's important. The only reason why I and Jill Carlson got hired in El Paso, Texas, remember Jill, is because they needed white people because they had soldiers at Fort Bliss. That's what they told me when they hired me. Because everybody was Hispanic and like, you know what, part of our audience are white people from the Midwest and other parts of America, so we need to hire a white reporter. I'm like, all right. And I like being a minority. I thought it was cool. You know, they were honest with me, and that's why they hired me.
Yeah, no, that's cool to be a token. That's exciting.
Well, I worked hard, too. It's not like I didn't earn the job, but I'm just telling you, That's why I got hired.
Okay. All right. So this is, I guess, going next level here with these chief diversity officers. And did you have a chief diversity officer?
No, we just had an HR director and a news director who made decisions.
Right. Well, that's not enough anymore, of course.
Stuff.
And also you're bringing in outside consultants. So, for example, Donna Lowry is a dye trainer from the Poynter Institute. Oh, the much revered Poynter Institute, the beacon of journalistic standards. What a joke that is. Donna Lowry, again, brought in because the chief diversity officer, what you're getting from Grady Tripp, that's not enough. You need to bring in a consultant from the Poynter Institute to properly enlighten staff about diversity and power training, you know, what power really is. You got to understand these concepts.
Influence is synonymous with power, you know, how much influence you can have. So power is the ability to influence outcomes and affect others. So we know that. And first, let's define power a little bit more closely, because we want you to think, how can you use your power to create the newsroom you deserve?
Create the newsroom you deserve. See how inward looking this is.
That is just a waste of time.
Brett Mauser reacting to Donna Lowry, because that was a watershed moment for him in terms of his deciding to come forward and speak to James O'Keefe. Again, Brett Mauser is the former promotions producer at the CBS affiliate in San Antonio, reacting to that, what you just heard from Donna Lowry, that outside consultant from the Poynter Institute.
So this is Poynter Institute has brought in Donna Lowry, training the newsroom about oppressor versus oppressed power dynamics in the news.
Yes, and this is what really caught my attention. This was a three-day training. The first half hour of the first day, I was like, okay, maybe I'm blowing this out of proportion. Maybe this isn't that big. But halfway through, after they started telling us, okay, we need you to take age, race, sexual orientation, and put them in order of importance to you, how you see the power dynamic. It just hit me like a ton of bricks, and I thought, it's dividing oppressor into oppressed.
Much of what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, and so has that been going on since the beginning of time? Is that something that you experienced in newsrooms?
Yes.
Oh, really? You ranked all these categories, and you said which is important to you, and you had discussions about power and how to create the newsroom you deserve. You had those discussions at NBC5?
All I could tell you is they would rank, like, do we need a male? It was gender first. Back then it was gender first, and then ethnicity, what, you know, ethnic group they belong to. And then, but sex and, you know, sexual preference, that wasn't part of the conversation.
Right. So
back
yes,
then, I'm saying
they were then. Right. They were always left. I understand that. But what's happening now is, I mean, you could say it's a version 2.0 or 3.0. But from your time there, which was this century, this is a different environment. You have more personnel. You have more calcified race and identity based structuring.
Definitely. Yep.
You have creating the newsroom we deserve, and that's all predicated on getting the ranking of these identity characteristics in proper order. And again, this is all against the backdrop of what's the news product going to be. So when you're spending all this time obsessing about what the environment looks like, and then you're saying, you're being instructed about power and the power to change and the power to influence things. Of course, you have that power. Of course, unfortunately, these network affiliates, as dumb and unwatchable as they are, have influence over a lot of people who watch the unwatchable and who are dumb. Unfortunately, that's true. So what do we expect the work product to be? It'll be an outgrowth of what they've been indoctrinated, because, of course, most people who actually are employed, especially the on-air talent at these network affiliates, are room temperature IQs, too. Let's just be honest. These are news readers. These are people who don't really know anything. These are people who do these, you know, in, insufferable, ridiculous, inconsequential, context-free stories. So what do you expect from them? We should expect a lot less, and we should have been expecting a lot less for a long time. And Chicago is a case study in it because of this, you know, idiotic sort of, oh, the local celebrities, some newsreader, mouth-breathing newsreader on ABC or the NBC or CBS affiliate here, they're a joke. They're a punchline, almost without exception. Keith and Kankakee, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning. That was my point. That was the point I wanted to make. The newsreader has been mocked so many times, so many ways, TV, movies, even music. How they take themselves serious anymore, I don't get it. But they're on in every waiting room across America.
Right. Well, exactly my point is I'm not pretending that they don't have influence. They do have influence. And they have influence because they have a good TV voice like Bill Curtis, who's a moron. Doesn't know anything except about maybe tall grass fed beef. Yeah. You know something about that.
I don't think he's a moron.
So he should be a farmer. Okay, fine.
He's reinvented himself in retirement.
It's wonderful. Wonderful. The point is...
Grass fed beef is my fave. Yes.
Yeah, it's wonderful. But the point is what's happening there. I mean, it's just a microcosm of what's the situation in the media writ large. It's a microcosm of what's happening in corporate culture writ large. And I think at this granular level, since people seem to think like, oh, the local media is so much more accessible. You know, people tend to be very parochial in most places. And so if you get an understanding of what's happening locally that informs your sort of parochial mindset, maybe you start to get a better understanding of what's happening globally. Since people don't think locally, maybe if they're and maybe getting them to understand locally will get them to understand globally, to sort of paraphrase that anodyne think globally or think locally and act globally or whatever nonsensical refrigerator magnet tripe that the left and people like that have these network affiliate jobs have to say. Something that Brett Mauser said to close, too. I mean, here's a guy who's been in newsrooms for the better part of his career for a long time, so he has some perspective about what it used to be like versus what it is today, and this is that perspective.
There is a truth, a narrative that everyone basically comes out of college nowadays with, and the other side is to be dismissed, is to be ignored, and looked at as a hoax. And it is this agenda that is being forced down every station's throat now. This mindset has been able to grow and infect what was supposed to be the fourth pillar of society. The journalists are supposed to be our watchdogs. They're the ones that are supposed to be protecting us from the tyranny and supposed to be going out there and finding out and giving us the truth.
Right, and instead they're the comm shop for the petty tyrants, aren't they? That's different. Comm shop for the petty tyrants. Oh, you know what I'd love? I'd love one of these training sessions to involve a survey of these television journalist hardy har har reading lists. What do you read on a daily basis? What are the last 5 books you read? Can you imagine what that would look like? Yeah, what do you think that would look like, Amy? Do you have any comment on that?
I think that would. I don't know. Depends on how many. It depends on the anchor you ask. I think certain anchors are well. Warner Saunders was well read.
Yeah, it would be mostly definitely coloring books.
No.
Or you know, teenage graphic novels or something like this. Yeah, it would be a joke. It would be something that would embarrass them, and you would be embarrassed for them. But it would be revelatory. That's what maybe we could figure out a way to do that. They're so dumb, they'd probably fill out a survey if it came from the right organization. Maybe if I come up with a phony baloney thing that sounds like the ACLU or that sounds like the Poynter Institute, the Poynter Foundation.
Yeah, the Poynter Foundation.
And I'll spell it POI. They won't know the difference. Maybe if I did that, they would actually fill it out. Oh boy, that would be great fodder for a discussion, wouldn't it? All right, I'll get to work on that. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Jim Jordan, the ranking Republican member on House Judiciary, got a tip from inside the Justice Department, a missive that was sent out after the Merrick Garland domestic terrorist characterization, effectively, of parents who were creating a ruckus at school board meetings by disagreeing with school boards over curriculum or COVID-related issues.
Yeah, those domestic terrorists, right? If you stand up for your parents, or stand up for your children, that's what they labeled you.
Timothy Langan and Calvin Shivers, counterterrorism division, Mr. Langan, criminal division, Mr. Shivers, Carlton Peoples, deputy assistant director, criminal investigative division of the FBI. Joint message from the Criminal Investigative Division and Counterterrorism Division, Federal Bureau of Investigation, per this October 4th memo from Merrick Garland, addressing a spike in harassment, intimidation, threats of violence against school administrators, board members, teachers, and staff. The Counterterrorism and Criminal Division created a threat tag, EDU officials, EDU officials, to track instances of related threats. We ask your offices apply the threat tag to investigations and assessments of threats specifically directed against school board administrators, board members, teachers, and staff. The purpose of the threat tag is to help scope this threat on a national level and provide an opportunity for comprehensive analysis of the threat picture for effective engagement with law enforcement partners at all levels. When evaluating the potential threats, we ask you to identify the following. Is there a federal nexus? Are there potential federal violations that can be investigated and charged? What's the motivation behind the criminal activity? Uh-huh. Well, that drew this letter from Jim Jordan. You were questioned, this is to Garland, you were questioned in the hearing on October 21st about the Department of Justice's press release touting the inclusion of the National Security Division, the departmental component responsible for enforcing federal terrorism laws, including the Patriot Act, and a task force that you created and have stubborn and it is part of this. You have stubbornly refused to rescind your directive, even though you testified that the National School Board Association letter was the basis for your memorandum. The whistleblower disclosure calls into question the accuracy and completeness of your testimony before the committee. At best, if we would assume you were ignorant of the FBI's actions in response to your October 4th memorandum at the time of your testimony, this new evidence suggests that your testimony in committee was incomplete and requires additional explanation. If you were aware of the FBI's actions at the time of the testimony, this evidence shows that you willfully misled the committee about the nature and extent of the department's use of federal counterterrorism tools to target concerned parents at school board meetings. And so, of course, this is, you know, pending a response from Garland. But just in terms of this idea that Garland testified to when he was before that House committee, that this was just, you know, raising the issue. This is not targeting parents. I'm not calling anybody a domestic terrorist. Well, you're calling people potential suspects of domestic terrorism when you have this collection of federal law enforcement divisions focused on identifying these threats that are that have been identified by the National Association of School Boards, at least that's been characterized by that organization, a characterization you adopted, and then you dispatched people within the Department of Justice and the FBI to proceed accordingly. And so they have been creating a tag, EDU officials.
So Merrick Garland lied to everybody.
Well,
because it sounds like it, and I wonder if Scott Smith.
Either lied.
I wonder
he
if
either
they
lied or he did, or he was ignorant. Either way, that doesn't cast him in a very positive light. 312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA turnkey.pro text line. And by the way, this is against the backdrop of, say, oh, I don't know, for example, Loudoun County school officials characterizing parents seeking to replace members of the Loudoun County School Board in Virginia as alt-right. Julie Briskman, who basically turned giving the middle finger to Donald Trump's motorcade into a candidacy, successful campaign for the school board in Loudoun County. She said, a successful campaign for the Loudoun County Board of Supervisors, not the school board. But she said that parents trying to recall members of the Loudoun County School Board are alt-right. She said that in a tweet. Well, there you go. Now you have the predicate accusation for some dogged FBI investigator to pick up and run with. These parents initiating a recall effort for Loudoun County School Board members have, it's been suggested, they're alt-right, you know, which is just the way that the left attacks anybody that opposes them. You're a white supremacist, you're alt-right, you know, you're a subversive, you're an insurrectionist, so on and so forth. And so will something like that open an investigation into those parents behind the recall effort of Loudoun County School Board members? I don't know. Would it? Merrick Garland? Does anybody have an answer to that? Is this a proper use of federal law enforcement power? Is this a proper area of federal law enforcement inquiry? You're telling me what's happening in school board elections or what's happening at a school board regarding COVID policy or curriculum is not something that can be handled by local law enforcement? If that's true, then you have a local law enforcement problem. You do not have a domestic terrorism problem that is beyond the scope of local law enforcement.
And if Merrick Garland, no one's going to trust him anymore because he went out and he lied. Did he have to swear? Was a testimony under oath that he gave when he said, no, we're not doing that. We're not treating parents as domestic terrorists. Because that would be a problem.
Well, I mean, lying to Congress, I mean, who is that a problem for? It's not a problem for Jim Comey. It's not a problem for Tony Fauci. Why would it be a problem for Merrick Garland, even though he's the chief law enforcement official in our country? Why would it?
It's just another form of intimidation. So parents are, shut up, be quiet, and don't rock the boat.
And by the way, with due respect, where are FBI agents? And I'm not just talking about retirees who have the ability to comment from the sidelines now. Where are FBI agents saying no to this? Saying that this is beyond the pale, that this is not a proper use of our resources. It is not consistent with our agency mission statement. It is a unfair characterization of parents. By the way, who protects the parents from these rapacious school board members when it comes to targeting? I don't know. Say, for example, the superintendent of Scottsdale School District that compiles a dossier on parents who questioned policy at school board meetings.
Oh, come on. Every school board has a list of trouble parents. When they get up to speak again, they're like, oh, there she is again. Okay, limit your time to 3 minutes, please.
They know. Oh, really?
Oh.
Oh, really? Every school district has a list of parents with their social security numbers, financial records, divorce records, and so on and so forth.
Not
as
that
a,
much
as a dossier that's compiled. Every school district does that, really.
No. I'm sorry. I was just, I forgot that they compiled the dossier with the social security numbers, divorce or marital status, and all that.
Well, you should kind of remember
taking
that.
It a little too far.
That's really key here. So no, not every school district does that, but that school district's doing that. So who protects the parents from that sort of targeting by school officials? Who protects the parents when you have a local prosecutor, as you do in, I think it's Fairfax County. It was Loudoun County. Loudoun County, along with the school board officials and teachers and administrative staff, this Facebook group that, you know, is organized opposition to parents challenging the school board's decisions on critical race theory or other matters. When you have a prosecutor, local prosecutor, saying that lying to a parent whose daughter was raped in school, I'm with them. I'm with the people that covered that up. So who protects the rights of those parents in Loudoun County, that family in particular, but just generally speaking, just using that as an example, or the parents in Scottsdale, Arizona? Do we have a kind of comment from law enforcement about that? Would Merrick Garland like to weigh in on that?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Mike and Hammond, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer. Mike.
We dodged the bullet with Merrick Garland not getting on the Supreme Court. Good grief. And also, I already commented to your screener that, yeah, the FBI agents are complicit with this. Say what you will. Everybody says, oh, 99% of them are good, but baloney on that. When this continually happens, whether it's a Steele dossier with Trump or this type of thing, yeah, the FBI agents are complicit. They know what they're doing. Or the raids on these guys' homes that are conservative people, or the offices,
yeah, right.
And you never hear it on the other side ever.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Right, right. I hear from some FBI agents about the raid on James O'Keefe for Ashley Biden's diary.
Yeah.
What? This is another matter for the FBI?
And was it even at his house? No.
He turned it over to local law enforcement
right.
when they decided not to publish it.
Months earlier.
What,
I know.
What is this? How is this within the purview of the FBI? Well, does anyone want to explain that? Merrick Garland?
And also they took his cell phone and all his information and his contact information. That is none of their business.
Yeah, well, they've been enjoined from extracting information from his phone. But still, what the hell are they doing? Christopher Wray?
There's real,
anybody?
Yeah, there's real criminals out there, guys.
Jordan in Forest Park.
Yeah, I think that when Garland is brought before any of these committees again, somebody should ask him the following question. How many protesters over the last 12 to 18 months have been placed in the same category as these parents? Give me a number.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Give me a number.
Well, thanks for the culture. Compare the number of parents in the EDU officials file to, say, files you have on Antifa or Black Lives Matter. Do you have any? Is Antifa an extremist group? I mean, you don't need to ask questions. You need just to look at file footage from local news reports about what Antifa did in Portland, for starters. What kind of inventory of information do you have on people who laid siege to American cities last year, since we're up against the backdrop of the Rittenhouse verdict pending? You know, what do you got? Yeah, and to Jordan's point, yeah. So when you're thinking about parents being identified by somebody or some school district as potential threats, you know, compare and contrast the standards you're using when it comes to parents at school board meetings, say, to Antifa, to street protesters that routinely engage in violence, that actually promote the use of violence the way that Antifa does. I'd love to hear that distillation. I completely agree. Todd in Cincinnati. Hey, Todd.
Hello.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, my quick comment was with the so-called threats against the school board. That all started with Joe Biden, who should be arrested when he threatened the sitting president during a debate, saying that he would take him behind the school gym and beat the hell out of him. Not to mention, quit voting for the board, and I think it's time to have a tax revolt. Quit voting for the school taxes. That's my only comment. I thank you for your time and listen to you every morning.
Thanks so much, Todd. Appreciate it. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Good morning. You know, I don't know why anybody trusts Merrick on the left trusts Merrick Garland. You know, he went to Niles West High School. I think he graduated in 70 or 71. And you know what their old mascot was? The Indians.
Yeah, the Indians.
Now,
took down the totem pole. Yes, we're very
now,
familiar
now
with
it's
that.
The Wolves. But he didn't do anything about it. He didn't do anything. I don't think he did anything about it. It might be a good episode for Cold Case Files with Bill Curtis right here on A&E.
That's great.
Or it could be one. You asked me about Sanjay Gupta the other day. Did I do an imitation for him?
Yeah.
Do it.
I don't.
Oh,
but I do one for Christian Amanpour. You know, she's a serious journalist, Dan and Amy. She does great journalism on CNN. And she could maybe look into Loudoun County and what's going on there. Maybe we need a show from her.
You're like our Frank Caliendo. This is great.
Yeah.
Do you do impersonations for the kids in your classes?
Oh, yes.
Or of them?
Kind of,
that's great.
Can
you do a Dan Proft impersonation, please?
No, I can't. He's too.
Oh. Can you work on it?
That's right. That's exactly
I'll work
right.
on that.
Yeah.
I can't
do be
Sebastian,
imitated.
Sebastian Gorka, though, can do him.
I'm here for
all right.
Pipe.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Good stuff. I forgot his point. I have no idea why he called. Mary Kay in Western Springs.
Hey, good morning, y'all. God, he's so damn funny. I love that guy.
Yeah,
what the hell are
Mary Kay, watch your mouth.
What did I say? What
you
the
said
hell
two...
are they doing?
Oh, okay.
No, wait, Dan asked that question 1 minute ago. What the hell are they doing? So here's at the meetings, you know? All right, so I think they should, I don't know if they already have cops sitting in on the meetings, you know, maybe they're citizens, but why don't they have cops and security standing right behind the people who attend the board meetings so they can be taken right off to prison? I've been to the board meetings around here. Why not? I mean, they belong in jail. But these board meetings are, you know, they used to be jovial, funny, ha-ha, everything. You know, it was just relaxing because there was nothing going on around here. The kids are all perfect. The parents are all perfect. You know, they didn't even handle the meeting normally, like the minutes, why are we here? They never, when parents weren't around, but there were some meetings where parents were never there. They would just go through the process. I mean, they weren't doing anything. Now they're under the gun. Now they're getting criticized. And they just don't like it. That's all. Merrick Garland, too, he's not going to say anything. He doesn't say anything anyway. You watch that guy? Yeah. I mean, what a joke. I watch that guy. I'm like, I even said to John a few weeks ago, who is that guy? You know, because I can't pay attention.
He was almost
a Supreme Court judge.
Thanks for the call, Mary Kay.
He doesn't have a spine, thank God.
No, he's a company man.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Interesting thing about Garland's family, too, since Frank brought up the fact that he was up there in the Niles Skokie area where he went to school, Niles West.
Yeah.
I believe his family is originally from the South Side, and I believe his family was part of the white flight from Chicago to the suburbs. So, again, Merrick Garland didn't do anything about, you know, has nothing to say about that. He has nothing to say about mascots. He's just a company man. He's not a leader.
Right.
He's just doing what he's told. It's the same thing as, like, Ali Mayorkas, who's Muriel from Animal Farm. I mean, they're just playing their roles as
they're
functionaries
just puppets,
for the state.
Puppets. Same with Pete Buttigieg.
Mayor
until they make him vice president.
Matt in Mount Greenwood.
Bad rumor.
Hey, Matt, Mount Greenwood.
They're Hey there, Dan and Amy, good morning. I just want to keep it to the FBI, and I'll equate them with a lot of the teachers. You know, the silent majority are too afraid to say anything for fear of losing their jobs and their pensions. You can say a whole lot about Black Lives Matter as well, but no, you're absolutely right. People are cowering. You know, living on the South Side, we know a lot of teachers. Teachers want to say something, but they get bullied. They flat out get bullied, and they tell us that. So.
Yeah.
Have a good day, folks.
Thanks for the comment. No, I understand. I understand the risks associated with it. But, boy, oh, boy, the idea that that saying nothing is risk-free because then I keep my job, I get my pension, and I live happily ever after. Well, okay, possibly. If you are, living beyond yourself or your kids or your grandkids, you know, think about the consequences for what you're not saying and what you're not doing in terms of the kind of society they're going to live in. Guarantee there won't be any place to run. I mean, the idea that, again, there are no trade-offs you're making by saying salary and pension and I just stay quiet and I'm complicit with these sort of violations and the degradation of a free society without consequence because we'll escape. Your escape might be a lot more temporary than you might otherwise like to think. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, would you buy stock in the Chicago Bears if you could? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. There's a resolution, which means nothing, but a resolution, it's an idea to model the Chicago Bears after the Green Bay Packers and have it be a nonprofit public corporation. That's a way to keep it in Chicago, according to one Alderman George Cardenas.
Yeah, who wants to buy into that? But the McCaskies have owned the Bears forever. They're not going to give up ownership to the city of Chicago and to the people of Chicago. So I don't know does he think eminent domain that they can just city council and the mayor could just come and take the Bears away from them?
No, that's not going to happen. A thank you to Bears fans for suffering through the McCaskey ownership years. They could gift the Bears to the city and they could set up a public corporation a la what the Packers did 100 years ago. I mean, it's publicly owned. By the way, the Green Bay Packers are publicly owned, but, their shares aren't, really worth anything. Essentially, it's like being a VIP member of, a Packer booster club. You sort of have the share you bought for $250 or whatever it was. I think that was the price, in the most recent stock offering a decade ago or so, but whatever. The shares can't be resold except back to the team for a fraction of the price. You get it's not like common or preferred stock. No equity interest, doesn't pay dividends, can't be traded.
Oh, really?
No protection under securities law. It's no season ticket purchasing preference either.
Really?
You basically get an invitation to the annual meeting and an opportunity to purchase shareholder only merchandise.
Oh, like
T-shirts
or
merchandise
and gadgets?
At shareholder only prices. Yeah,
things like that. Okay.
So it's an affinity play. It is different because it's governed by a committee, and the only compensated person is the president of the executive committee. That's how the Packers works. As a problem right now because the NFL requires single ownership or ownership by a small group. At least one owner must have a third of the ownership interest. So you'd have to work around the NFL. The reason the Packers could do it is because their corporation was set up 100 years ago, predating this NFL rule, so they're grandfathered in. The Bears wouldn't be. But, it's just interesting, the desperate measures that the city is contemplating or putting out there as a way to keep the Bears because they know the Bears are leaving, and they probably understand that the Chicago sky is not going to fill that void.
Oh, hey, no. Hey. But Chicago Fire could.
For more on the topic, yeah, right. Okay, John Cass.
Soccer.
For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Jim Urio, Fox Business contributor and proprietor of Brands in Palatine. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, guys.
What do you think? What do you think about that novel idea from one of our deep-thinking aldermen?
Here's the problem, and I've heard a couple different aldermen speak, and some of, one guy came out and said we shouldn't let the Bears move down. What is implicit in that is that a lack of respect for any sort of private property if it disagrees with what the city thinks. They have to remember that by the way, full transparency. I live in Palatine. I have a restaurant that's 3 miles from the new site. The Bears, so I am staked in this more than most people
right.
are. So would I like the Bears to move to Arlington Heights? Of course I would. So that being said, I think I can still speak unbiased on the topic. Anytime government starts talking about restricting private property rights, realistically, you can boil it down. There's only 3 main functions of government, national defense, infrastructure, and property rights. Education, things like that, they took all that stuff on over the last couple hundred years. That's a basic tenet of it. If they fail on that, they're failing completely, which, by the way, surprised they're failing completely.
Well, it's not if. The Bears are moving to Arlington Heights.
How do you know this 100%? Because I don't like to get my hopes up too much. I really want this to happen. They bought the property.
They
bought the property. Yeah, and then they've got casinos so they can have gaming as part of their,
Good.
But Cardenas is trying
to get some fun.
Cardenas simply wants City Hall to be creative to try and keep the Bears, but there's nothing they can do to keep them. It's over.
Right. And I it's funny to me because to be someone who's so frustrated with the way the city of Chicago has run their business over the last few years, to see them lose the Bears, there's this weird, perverse satisfaction. And again, this is coming from a guy who benefits from it. But when you do make stupid decisions, you get stupid results. I mean, everything happens for a reason, but the reason might be that you're an idiot and you have to now suffer the consequences of your decision.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good.
Look, I mean, we're all gloating. If the Bears were actually a publicly traded company, I would buy stock in it, not because I'm confident what the product they're going to put on the field, but because that's such a growth play to be in Arlington Heights with the ability to build a Bearsville and to not have to do business in the city of Chicago and negotiate leases with the Park District and so on and so forth to build a bigger stadium, to have more amenities. So on. I mean, it's a great growth play for the organization. So from a money-making perspective, it's a no-brainer.
Right, it's 330 acres that the train comes right to. There's highway access on just about all sides. It's definitely a layup, in my opinion. So, but again.
All right, so somebody who presents more of a threat than George Cardenas' resolution to the seizure of private property by the public sector. And this is just indicative of the mentality of this administration. I'm talking about the Biden administration now. Again, their currency exchequer nominee, this Moscow State University scholar, Saleh Omarova, and the things that she said in the past, of course, are coming out now because her nomination is in real trouble because she's got a couple of Democrats that aren't going her way either. But this is what she said about her vision for private banking. Her vision for private banking is there will be none.
Imagine what would it be like if instead of being just a public option for deposit banking, this would be actually the full transition. In other words, there will be no more private bank deposit accounts, and all of the deposit accounts will be held directly at the Fed. And there are very interesting implications from that thought experiment, for example, with the much more direct and proactive tools of monetary policy, like helicopter money, which is, considered radical, primarily because economists really do not know how to manage the issue of what will happen in the inflationary environment when the central bank needs to contract the supply of money. How is it politically feasible for the central bank to effectively take money away from people's accounts?
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that thought experiment, the elimination of private deposits, Jim?
So here's what I think about that, too. And believe me, this is the kind of thing that keeps me up at night. I believe that these appointees, at this point in time, they're going for the least qualified people, the person who will make the other side the most angry. So to a casual observer who doesn't understand that she's an absolute communist, she's said that in the past, that she's put there, and then we, people like the three of us who pay attention, say she's a communist, and then the other side can look at us and go, wow, crazy conspiracy theorist people. So this is where we've evolved to. This is the progress they were talking about in the progressivism, I guess, because this is just, it absolutely blows me away, and the things she talks about the government taking over all the banking system is terrifying. It should be terrifying to everybody.
Well, President Biden, they signed the $1 trillion infrastructure bill, and everything's going to be better now, Jim.
My message
to
the American people is this. America's moving again, and your life is going to change for the better.
Our life is going to change for the better, Jim. Isn't that exciting?
Okay, well, I'm sold. Then he's fine. He won me over. Because he did say, remember what he said, there's no inflation. He looked at the camera and he said it like three times about 4 months ago or something like that, or it's going to go away. So I think if he thinks he can look at the camera and say what he wants and nobody challenges him, and he seems to be right at this point in time.
Part of the Biden administration agenda here with the socialist tax and spendathon, the $4 trillion in funny money that's pending, is this little nugget. You know, always looking at the housing market, and of course it's been on fire, and of course, more so because of the inflationary environment. But Wall Street Journal reporting that Fannie and Freddie are expected to raise their conforming loan limits to about $650,000, about $100,000 more, and nearly $1 million in high-cost markets from $800,000 to $1 million in high-cost markets from $822,000, which is you know, 175 grand more. So there, this is important because Fannie and Freddie guarantee mortgages up to the conforming loan limit. This government backstop and de facto subsidy, the raising the limits because home prices are up 23% over year over year, is this the government contributing to re-blowing up the housing bubble that was blown up by these same enterprises in advance of 2008?
I guess here's what blows me away about that. Well, first of all, I would say, of course it is. And when you look at what happened, you know, the run-up, the 15 years preceding 2008, and you thought, that's not that long ago. I'm surprised we're making the same mistakes. And that, by the way, that's an enormous mistake made by the government. But now let's look at the Fed's mistake. You mentioned that the housing market's hot. The housing market is absolutely red hot, and the statistics back that up. Even this month, the Federal Reserve is going to be buying $35 billion of mortgage-backed bonds to support the housing market, which is already dangerously hot and entering into bubble territory. Now, the bubbles can last a long time, as we've seen before. But to ask the question, is the Fed and the federal government contributing to this recreating a bubble? Of course they are. And it doesn't seem like they care anymore. It reminds me of the Barney Frank speech, you know, about 6 months before the whole thing blew up, where he's in Congress talking about, and it's a great watch if you haven't seen it yet. I want everyone to tell me there's a bubble in the housing market. He says, there you go. I think we should roll the dice on this. And these people, they don't seem to care. Because, again,
guys,
then the housing market implodes, and he's the one who gets to form the legislation to apparently supposedly address it going forward.
Well, right, because so this move is against the backdrop of constricting supply through tax increases, expanding demand through funny money and the launching of new entitlements, and that is going to reduce inflation, we're told.
Yep, that's what I've been told. So to say it's a head-scratcher is giving it way too much credit. It's just a blatant lie. Now, I would say that the artificial demand that's been propped up through government policies and Fed policies over the last 2 years is very real, and that's one of the most primary things. But there's actually organic demand that has happened since people seem to come out of their bunkers and see what's going on at the tail end of the pandemic. So that's real, too. There's that element as well. But then, yeah, then you restrict the supply as well. This is literally the first day of Econ 101, demand supply equals inflation. You know, we're boosting demand, limiting supply. Of course, we're seeing that happen. And the fact that it's taken them, well, it took them like 8 months even to acknowledge that it was here. Right. And then a week ago, when the CPI number came out, remember the stock market got hit pretty hard because it was believed that the Fed now can't ignore inflation any longer with a hot CPI number. But now we're into potentially electing a new Federal Reserve chair, and he's being threatened because he's not dovish enough. So to think that this is going to end soon, I think, is folly.
I would want to get your quick take, too, on where crypto is at, where you're at with crypto, I guess I should say, against the run-up of Bitcoin and just sort of more froth over in the crypto space because of what's going on in the traditional fiscal and monetary space.
Well, there's a couple things that I think are really interesting about crypto. And I'm sure I've told you this before, but for the last several years, just one day a week, I have an automatic crypto purchase in three different coins. I don't know exactly what they are as far as the nuts and bolts, but I know a couple things. One, they're absolutely a hedge against fiat currency. That's what they came about for, because they're telling us that people aren't confident in the stewardship of our currency. The reason I own it is because I own about 10 or 12 different things that are all along those lines: platinum, silver, gold, real estate. And I have a whole dollar hedge portfolio. I should rename it. The government is moronic and doesn't know a good thing when they have it, which is the strong king U.S. dollar. And they are playing games with that. Now, the crypto market's grown to $3 trillion. There's another element of it. You know, we keep talking about the lack of labor, right? So when you talk about the Fed that's inflating asset prices, there's been 3.2 million extra baby boomers that have retired in the last year and a half. That's extra from what was normally projected. Now, I'm getting back to crypto. The crypto, it's a $3 trillion market now. How many people are taking government money and staying home and calling themselves a crypto trader? So I actually think that market needs to implode. And I'm not wishing losing money on anybody, but that market needs to implode to remind a new generation of what risk is, so we don't to avoid bubble creation. But crypto at some point in time is going to get knocked, And you know, I'm in it, and it's a hedge, so I don't mind losing my money. But I think it's fascinating.
He is Jim Uriel, Fox Business contributor. He's the number one fan of the Arlington Heights Bears because he owns Brandt's and Palatine.
Oh, it's going to be great.
Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're going to have to get a bigger restaurant, Jim.
We're talking about it already.
See?
I like it.
There you go. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Back in September, Alejandro Mayorkas, the Secretary of Department of Homeland Security, went on the Sunday talkies to explain the administration's position on those horsebound Border Patrol agents who were alleged to have mistreated Haitian migrants, the so-called whipping.
Yes.
Wrongly accused of that, of course. Joe Biden said that they will be held to account.
Right.
Alejandro Mayorkas was horrified at the images. Remember this famous formulation by Mayorkas about what exactly we're investigating? This was when he appeared with Jake Tapper, leads in with Biden's comments and then Mayorkas.
I promise you those people will pay. They will be an investigation underway now, and there will be consequences. There will be consequences.
I will not prejudge the facts. I do not in any way want to impair the integrity of the investigative process.
But, Mr. Secretary, you also said that the images, quote, horrified us. How can DHS claim to have an independent investigation into these Border Patrol agents when the president says, quote, those people will pay, and you say the images horrified us?
Jake, I think it's quite clear that what the images suggest horrified the American public. That is quite different than learning what actually happened, determining the facts, and the fact determinations will be made in an independent investigation by the Office for Professional Responsibility.
I mean, this is a former U.S. attorney. Supporting the launching of an investigation and covering for Biden's comments, they will be held to account. Well, that's a judgment that's been made. For what appears to be the case, so that he doesn't have to comment on what we knew to be the case prior to that investigation. It's really smarmy business by Mayorkas there. And then he went on Joy Reid and said this independent investigation that he's very serious about will be completed post haste and the results released to the public for consumption.
And that's captured by photographers with respect to the activities of Border Patrol agents on horseback. We do not condone, we do not tolerate any mistreatment of any migrant. What we did is we directed an immediate investigation of the events that were captured in the photographs and on video. I have ensured that the top leadership of the Office of Professional Responsibility lead that investigation and that it be conducted thoroughly and swiftly. We need this resolved swiftly, and in fact, I anticipate that the results of the investigation will be available by the end of next week, and I have committed to making those results public.
That was the third week of September.
I know. I remember when these pictures were released and people on social media compared them to slave catchers in the antebellum South. I mean, they were the split reins is what you used to maneuver the horse with. They were not whipping Haitians with it.
Mayorkas saying there, and then Joy Reid's little program, that he doesn't condone the mistreatment of migrants. Well, that sort of indicates that you believe they were mistreated in this case. That doesn't sound like somebody who's withholding judgment. It sounds like somebody who's trying to walk the line for the administration, which is what he's actually doing, and which is why I've characterized him as Muriel from Animal Farm. If you don't get the reference, look it up. So those statements from September by Mayorkas. Now, yesterday, he's before Senate Judiciary Committee, and Mike Lee raises this issue of the dispensation of the case. Where is it? The dispensation of the investigation. And if Mayorkas thinks he afforded himself well as it pertains to standing up for his personnel in that moment.
What about the issue with your Border Patrol agents recently being accused by some folks in the media of whipping illegal immigrants when in fact they were not? Why on earth did you not defend them? I mean, has no one in your entire department ever become aware of how one uses split reins when riding a horse?
Oh, Senator, let me say two things. Number one, I put 100% into my work, and I'm incredibly proud to do so. That's number one. Number two, I stand with the men and women of our department through and through, and I will not prejudge facts before.
Did you defend them when they were being attacked for whipping people, which they were not?
Senator, what I said quite clearly is that the independent investigation will determine the facts, and those facts will drive the outcome.
Okay.
Nothing less and nothing more.
Your response and your failure to defend them then and now is nothing short of morale crushing. If you want to maintain or obtain operational control of the border, which you do not now have, this is not a way to get there.
Not to mention, now you have this cloud hanging over those Border Patrol agents for the last 2 months when you were very clear in your language, Mr. Mayorkas, that this would be done a week after you were on the Tapper and Joy Reid shows.
And also, too, they took away the horses, and anyone who's ever been with Border Patrol agents, that's part of what they need to do their job. They have to have those horses because the terrain is so marshy down there because you're by the Rio Grande.
For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Josh Mandel. He's a United States Marine Corps veteran, Special Intelligence, and he is a Republican candidate for U.S. Senate in Ohio, running to replace the retiring Rob Portman. Josh Mandel, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, guys. Good to be on.
Mayorkas gave himself an A for effort with his administration of Homeland Security so far. How would you grade him based on what he said to Mike Lee and just in general?
Listen, Mike Lee is one of my favorite senators. I'm going there to be an ally and really to be reinforcements for him. And I think Senator Lee did a great job of questioning him and holding his feet to the fire. Listen, the issue is bigger than this specific moment, this specific situation. The issue is in this country. The left, they're done with and sick of innocent until proven guilty. And like that is a principle of American justice of our system is that the presumption of innocence. And what the left does is they throw that out the window and they prosecute people in the court of public opinion. You see it, you know, you've seen it time and time again with a lot of these police shootings where police were doing their job and defend themselves, but the left did everything they could, aided by the media, to publicly prosecute cops. And in this case, you see the same thing with Border Patrol agents. And listen, I've been down there. I've been on the Rio Grande. I've done tours of the border with the Border Patrol, and it's a hairy neighborhood. It's a very difficult job to do, and we should always be giving our Border Patrol agents the benefit of the doubt.
But when are they going to give this up? I mean, I think if anybody looks at the photographs, they realize they weren't being whipped. And in fact, you see one of the Haitians actually grabbing the bit of the horse, trying to pull the horse down. I mean, do you think, since they dug in their heels so much that they can't admit that they're wrong?
I think that's a big part of it. But let's ask a bigger question. There is an enormous body of water between Haiti and Texas. How did 15,000 Haitians, one of the poorest countries in the world, get from Haiti to Texas? That doesn't happen by accident. This isn't a crisis. This is an invasion. It's a Soros-funded, Obama-coordinated, Biden-enabled invasion of our country.
And just on the matter, too, these bigger issues, and I agree about the what these indicate. These are examples that indicate a bigger crisis afoot. We have the same thing with the Rittenhouse case that is now with the jury, where Joe Biden characterized him as a white supremacist right from the outset without having any facts either. Then candidate for president, no less, candidate for president, characterizing Kyle Rittenhouse as a white supremacist. I mean, that's another example of guilty until proven innocent.
Absolutely. Listen, I'll give you an example. When I was in the Marine Corps, my second tour, I served in a town called Haditha. And, you know, one of the units that was in Haditha before our unit was there, you know, there was a situation that the media and some politicians described as the quote-unquote Haditha massacre. Well, at the end of the investigation of the quote-unquote Haditha massacre, no one was charged with murder or anything like that, or no one was found guilty of murder or anything like that. But I tell you what, the politicians and the media, they ruined some of these Marines' lives and careers. And they have no problem with that. The media and the Democrat Party, which are now one and the same, the media is a department of the Democrat Party, they treat Marines, soldiers, sailors, airmen, cops, Border Patrol agents guilty until proven innocent. This is a serious, serious divide in our country where the left looks at anyone who's wearing a uniform, carrying a weapon to protect America as a bad guy. I mean, think about this. I mean, this is just counter to everything we learned as kids and everything we're trying to teach our kids. The left is trying to teach our kids that whether you're a cop, you're a Marine, you're a Border Patrol agent, you're a bad guy. It's wrong. It's horrible. And, I mean, that's the bigger issue we're dealing with here.
Well, and now sort of a corollary to that is those bad actors on the left, when they're caught having committed bad acts, there are no consequences. And
sure.
People are really frustrated with that, too. The prime example, a prime example, would be Adam Schiff. Adam Schiff and the lies that he told for years perpetuating the Russian collusion narrative. He's on with Chuck Todd just the other day, asked if any regrets now that we know with the indictments of Danchenko and Sussman, we know that the Christopher Steele dossier was trash. You were touting it. Any regrets? And he said this.
But you helped give it credibility. Do you regret it?
I don't regret saying that we should investigate claims of someone who, frankly, was a well-respected British intelligence officer. And we couldn't have known, of course, years ago that we would learn years later that someone who is a primary source lied to him.
Being on the left means never having to admit wrongdoing and never being held to account for wrongdoing, whether you admit it or not. And Schiff is a good case study in that.
Schiff is a perfect case study in that. And unfortunately, the lamestream media, the corporate media, they cover for them. My guess is if you kept playing that clip that Chuck Todd moved on to another question and didn't hold his feet to the fire.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, of course. You know, that's good enough. I just had to ask the question. I didn't mean to ruffle any feathers. I mean, that's the approach,
yeah,
right?
Just had to check the box.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's where this is at. And you know, this has real implications. Adam Schiff is a hack politician. We can get over hack politicians. But when it comes to agencies like the FBI, with the massive law enforcement power it has, as it pertains to Jim Comey and Andrew McCabe's bad acts, or as it pertains to Merrick Garland's slippery statements when he testified about targeting parents at school board meetings, you know, then you're starting to get into real dangerous waters in terms of the future of a free society, because people understandably lose faith in these institutions in which we're supposed to have faith.
You better believe it. You know, in my campaign here in Ohio for U.S. Senate, I've been speaking at school board meetings to try to defend and have the backs of the moms and dads who are trying to stop the mask mandate, the critical race theory, the, you know, teaching kids they could pick their genders and all this crazy stuff. I got kicked out of a school board meeting for just having the backs of these moms and dads.
Uh-oh.
And
you're a domestic terrorist.
Well, no, that's exactly it. So they kicked me out in total violation of their school board rules, in total violation of the First Amendment to the Constitution. But to your point about Merrick Garland and calling parents domestic terrorists, this school board president would not have felt empowered to do that, to trample on my First Amendment rights, to violate their own board rules, were it not for the Attorney General of the United States giving them cover.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a dangerous environment that the Biden administration has created, where they've made moms and dads and cops and Marines and Border Patrol agents out to be the bad guys.
He is Josh Mandel. He's a United States Marine Corps veteran, Special Intelligence. He's also a Republican candidate for U.S. Senate in Ohio to replace the retiring Rob Portman. You can get more information on his campaign at joshmandel.com. Josh, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks. We'll tell all our friends in Ohio to vote for you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest guests and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Columbus Day. Yeah, no, I know it's past, but it comes around every year. And one Wheaton-Warrenville School District 200 board member wants to make sure it doesn't come around again in Wheaton-Warrenville School District 200. Wheaton.
Wheaton. What happened to your Wheaton, Dan? You move out and all hell breaks loose.
It's going the way of the rest of DuPage County. Mm-hmm. It's going the way of the rest of Illinois. The school board member in question is named Mary Yeboah, and incredibly, she is the director of graduate student life at Wheaton College. So now you've got this cultural Marxist you're about to hear from who is elected to the Wheaton-Warrenville School District 200 board. She's the director of graduate student life at Wheaton College. Is there any vetting that goes on anymore? Are there any Christian or religious institutions that actually care about their institution's heritage and stated mission? I wonder. Mary Yeboah, at the most recent District 200 school board meeting, had six rhetorical questions for her fellow board members and, by extension, the public about Columbus Day.
One, does the District 200 administration recognize the impact of holidays, statues, and other memorials on shaping school culture, which in turn shapes student experiences and outcomes? Two, does the District 200 administration consider celebrating extreme violence, theft, genocide, and dehumanization to be in line with the study of social science to help students develop the ability to make informed and reasoned decisions for the benefit of the global society in which they live? Three, does the District 200 administration affirm the accurate telling of history and recognize the impossibility of discovering land already inhabited? Four, does the District 200 administration take into consideration the perspectives of indigenous people regarding this particular calendar event? Five, could maintaining this District 200 calendar event unintentionally support a myth of U.S. exceptionalism that could undermine district efforts to create diverse, inclusive schools for all children? Lastly, does this calendar event advance the vision and mission of District 200 goals? And if it does not, must it remain despite state level support?
Well, before we get to the meat of this, she sounds like a great person to take to a party. Whew. She talks like this.
Yeah, these important rhetorical questions. I know they were rhetorical in nature, but that doesn't mean no other board member on Wheaton-Warrenville School District 200 couldn't have commented if they wanted to. They didn't.
Of course not.
Well, of course not. I mean, nobody can think independently. Everybody agrees with the pointed answers that naturally flow from the loaded questions that she asked. She wants to eliminate Columbus Day, and she offers a bunch of specious characterizations of Columbus, which we've gone over, and I'm happy to do again with the help of actually scholars in the area like Carol Delaney, who's a professor emerita from Stanford, or William O'Connell, who's a historian at Seton Hall. Happy to go chapter and verse. Or the other Marxist PAP about, you know, diversity, inclusion, district goals, all of that. Wheaton College? Wheaton School District 200? I mean, I know Jeannie Ives and her crew with Breakthrough Ideas has been doing work at the local level, and Jeannie lives in Wheaton, so including at District 200. I know there have been parents that have shown up and pushed back. I know our friend Emma Woodhouse has addressed the school board there.
She recently moved there to Wheaton.
You know, for those of you that are still tilting at windmills about the near-term future of Illinois, thinking there is some paradigm shift away from the Democrat socialist ruling class afoot, Wheaton? Wheaton School District 200? Wheaton College? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro/answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro. Are you watching Yellowstone by any chance?
I am not, but I'm going to start because I finally got a Hulu account.
Anybody, for people watching Yellowstone, I mean, this is
people
everywhere.
Yeah,
this is the Kevin Costner, you know, he's a big ranch owner in Bozeman, Montana. That's where it takes place. So his daughter-in-law in the series, Costner's daughter-in-law in the series, is a teacher at the local college, and she's Native American. And every time we go to her at the college, we have to endure the same sort of claptrap from her in that popular series, and I think it's the most popular show on TV right now, about Columbus. You know, and we have to essentially endure this a false characterization of Native Americans as, you know, noble, the Rousseauian vision of noble savages, which, by the way, is a, you know, Rousseau/Marx construct, the noble savage, the purity, and so forth, as if Native Americans, just as Italian explorers of 500 years ago, were not men and women of their time. I mean, it will shock, I'm sure, some people to learn that Native Americans were not only enslaved, they kept slaves. And they like Europeans, essentially operated, not all, but some, operated under the Aristotelian view that, you know, to the victor go the spoils, including the ability to enslave those whom you conquer. Dangerous business. Dangerous business trying to pick and choose our understandings of history, to try to pick apart men and women of their time as compared to other men and women of their time. Happy to do the deep dig. Happy to discuss Columbus warts and all. But the idea that this should be tolerated and this should be used as a lever, which is what she's really doing here. It's not that sophisticated. Please follow along. This is paint-by-numbers stuff, folks. Using the Columbus Day thing as a lever for the larger race hustle, the larger Marxist play here, because that's who this Mary Yeboah clearly is. And why is this the first I'm hearing of her, and I'm sure the first, you know, particularly people outside of District 200 are hearing from her. Where are people leveling these individuals up for scrutiny and for intellectual pushback? Eric in Palatine, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. I think it's a great example of how we're falling asleep at the wheel. We're not paying attention to our local elections and small communities, and this is what happens. It's where everybody's worried about the federal and the big, you know, Trump this, hate everybody, and everybody forgets about the small stuff. It's a perfect example.
Yeah. Right. Thanks for the call, Eric. Right. You're giving away your backyard in pursuit of saving the world, right? The areas that you can exercise the most influence, and by the way, as I want to say, the areas that have the most influence over your day-to-day life: school boards, municipal governments, regional governments, state government, federal government last, unless maybe you're in a border town. Mark in Plainfield.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Two quick points. One, anytime someone uses the phrase myth of American exceptionalism, like this commie B did, should immediately be booed off the stage, challenged, ripped a new one. And my second point to her phrase, noble savages, how noble were these savages when they had daily human sacrifices to ensure the sun rose the next morning like the Mayans did?
Thanks for the call, Mark. I mean, just on the Columbus committed genocide, because that's sort of the top line accusation. He brought genocide to the West. This is what you hear from know-nothings who are repeating what they've heard from other know-nothings. Carol Delaney, writing about Columbus, he was friends with the natives. At his first encounter, he wrote, quoting Columbus, "I, in order that they would be friendly to us and would be converted to our holy faith by love, then by force, to some I gave red caps and glass beads, which they put on their chests and became so much our friends, it was a marvel." She goes on to say, they became good friends. Columbus wrote that, "Little by little, I will progress in understanding and acquaintance, and I will have this tongue taught to persons of my household." Soon he had to leave 22 men behind when he returned to Spain to get another ship. He took 6 natives with him and wanted to do more. They were baptized, and baptized people could not be enslaved. 2 decided to remain at court. 1 became Columbus's godson, who accompanied him on his other voyages and was an interpreter. 3 returned, though 1 died on the way. When he landed, he saw that all of the men who had remained were dead. He believed the men had gone against his orders not to go marauding and raping, but they did, and that the other group came and killed them. Here's what he wrote of the native people. Quote, "They should be treated courteously because they are the best and most gentle people in the world." He continually asked the sovereigns to send priests so they could be baptized and thus be saved and go to heaven when they died. This is not to say there were not grotesque crimes against humanity that were committed in a lot of directions, by the way. And again, these were men and women, mainly men here we're talking about in terms of culpability and responsibility, men of their time. And as William O'Connell, who I mentioned before, professor of historian at Seton Hall, has said, dangerous business to get into applying the morality of the 21st century to the morality of the 15th. Colleen in Wicker Park.
Hey, Dan. You sparked a thought in me while you were speaking of men of our time. Isn't the slavery of our time that when the Democrat Party is in charge and they come to us expecting us to provide for them and everybody else, we're an endless money pit? We're enslaved to our rulers, such as they are.
Thanks for the call, Colleen.
Hey, Dan, you forgot to mention, too, she was wearing a Black Lives Matter T-shirt when she was presenting in front of the board.
Of course she was.
Yeah. I mean, she teaches at Wheaton College, Director of Graduate Student Life at Wheaton College, and the new member of the school board.
John in Mount Prospect.
Hey, guys. Thanks. Great show. You made a comment earlier that board members not making comments when that woman spoke. Here's why. First off, it's not a meeting. It's not what they want to talk about is on the agenda for that night. And when you start making comments, I'm a board member of a public body, you end up falling into their dialogue. They start controlling the dialogue. The best thing to do is just nod your head and go, thank you for your comment, and move on. Move on to the business that needs to be discussed that night.
Yeah.
And what you don't want to do is give them, footholds and traction on the dialogue. And that's what's happening. And these little groups that they form create this organization that starts looking for traction into their discussion.
Yeah, but I mean, I hear what you're saying, and I know these school board meetings can be interminably long, and people want to do the business and get out, and you can't die on every hill, John. I get that. But I mean, I think there are certain moments where response is necessary so people understand that silence is not assent. And also, if you're going to have that sort of, even if it's not on topic, if she's going to go off topic on, this diatribe, then that should be called out, at least procedurally, if not substantively. I actually think both. I mean, I think where we're at now is just a different place. And just that sort of commentary, you know, has to be addressed in some material way. And if that sets a precedent where some of these meetings descend into squabbling about something some board member said, well, so be it. I'd rather have more squabbling than just the left having the run of the place and everybody moving on.
Okay, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you just got to realize what they're organized to come at you and come at you and come at you with their points.
I know.
They don't care about.
I know, but
they don't care about getting a business done needs to get done. It's really a sad state.
Yeah, John, thanks for the call. I hear you. I hear you. But I mean, but they're coming whether you say something or not. So I think it's better to, especially in this moment with what you see happening, what we see happening, you know, you have to have people stand up and say something. You cannot just be silent in the face of such rank ignorance. Otherwise, that will take hold. John in Palatine.
Hi, Dan. I've put my money where my mouth is, and I've actually walked to our conservative candidates in the Wheaton area and the northwest suburbs. And I have to say that many of the candidates, once pushed, they have the platform and they have the voice, and they are not at these meetings, and they are not backing down these Marxists. So it's really difficult when our so-called leaders aren't really standing up for the conservative causes.
Yes, right. Thanks for the call, John. Well, there was a good piece in the Wall Street Journal today about some convictions of union bosses in Philadelphia, and the last line was power without political power without political competition corrupts absolutely. A little spin on Lord Acton's famous aphorism: power without political corruption corrupts absolutely. That's what's happening in Illinois. No political competition. Margo in Burr Ridge.
Well, when I was a little girl, my grandmother related to me the story of her mother crossing the country in a Conestoga wagon. And along the way, they would stay in sod houses that were, you know, constructed by others. And twice, they came across families that had been massacred by the Indians. And in one of them, the Indians had actually taken the baby in its long gown and swung it by its gown and smashed its head to kill the baby, the infant. So this is what I related to my children when they came home with the white man bad, Indian good, you know, stories to me. You know, these people aren't alive now to tell their story, but there is another side to the Indian story. They were not angels. They were just men, and some of them not very nice. And mm-hmm. Our children need to know the whole truth about these things. They were terrified. My great-grandmother never stopped talking about it till the end of her day. It was so horrific.
Thanks for the call, Margo. Yeah. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Many people have made the comparison of Nick Sandman to Kyle Rittenhouse in terms of being tried and convicted and defamed in the media by media organizations and politicians and celebrities alike.
Oh yeah, they convicted him in the court of public opinion. They've never been on his side.
Now Nick Sandman is making that comparison.
Ooh.
He's written a commentary at the Daily Mail in which he writes, not only does Kyle have to deal with the taking of lives, but it's compounded with the overwhelming stress and trauma of the character assassination taking place against him. From my own experience, the death threats, feeling of no future ahead, and that millions of people hate you is enough to alter you in many concrete ways and permanently. Make no mistake, even the strongest of people cannot resist the mental impact when the media war machine targets you. With Kyle's name dragged through the mud and the clear effect it's having on him, many have started to ask the question whether Kyle should sue for defamation, While I'm by no means an attorney, I've gained some experience on the ins and outs of defamation, can offer an educated guess on what the outcome would be if Cal were to sue. And he goes on, he goes on to give you sort of the basics of a defamation case. And he also makes the point people probably don't know. He's still involved in a half a dozen lawsuits against media organizations, still to this day, three years later.
And he goes
on to write, if Kyle is prepared to take on another burden in his early life with the acceptance that it might result in nothing, I answer, give it a shot and hold the media accountable. One of the saddening parts of this media onslaught is that it has taken young people like Kyle and myself to expose how corrupt the media really is. From my own experience, I know this cannot be easy for Kyle. While I have waited to comment on the facts of Kyle's case until the trial ends, I cannot hold back on the media's public execution of him before the trial has concluded. For more on the topic, with the case now in the hands of the jury, pleased to be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, retired, president of the Herb London Center for Policy Research and author of Operation Dark Heart, Spycraft and Special Ops on the Front Lines of Afghanistan and the Path to Victory. Colonel Schaefer, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan, thanks for having me. It's good to join you.
What do you think about what Sandman had to say about Rittenhouse in the media specifically at this point?
So, look, I've had my tip with the media from time to time, and it's amazing how they will take what is clearly not true, something that they presume or want to be true, and use it against you constantly. So I feel terrible for Kyle. And the editorial points out the viciousness that these people, the level of viciousness that they go to try to damage you. And it does, you know, speaking of someone who's been, is a whistleblower, had to go through this gauntlet of hate, it's very unnerving. And, as Sandman said, you then have compounded on that the deaths that he legitimately defended himself and caused. And, speaking to someone who, again, has been kind of in his shoes, you don't like having to engage in shooting people, but there comes a point you have to do it. So in this case, I think the media is not only unfair, I think you've seen almost a desire to bring Kyle some sort of a I don't even know how to not describe it other than just wanting to hurt him. And that's reflected over and over in what you see in the mainstream media when they talk about this case and Kyle.
But don't you think the bigger issue, too, is the attack on the Second Amendment rights to defend yourself? Because a lot of people, this is another example why we should change the Second Amendment or amend the Second Amendment. Excuse me.
Yeah, no. Look, Amy, I agree. When Binger said that the moment you bring a gun to defend yourself, you lose the right to defend yourself. I'm paraphrasing here, but yeah, that's how insane this prosecution has been. We at the London Center have been working this issue. We actually worked with, we did a joint video with Sig Sauer for first-time gun ownership. We are all for safe gun ownership, safe use. With that said, use is the key. We believe you should be using the weapons that are available to you to defend yourself. And the moment the prosecution turned and made this about the basic fundamental right of an individual to carry a weapon and defend themselves, I think they crossed the line. And this has become not only about Kyle and his circumstance, but about the larger idea is if you or I go into a situation of chaos, do we have the right to defend ourselves? Do we have the right to have a weapon that is available to counter a likely force engagement? Or in the case of Kyle, where he's attacked by multiple people, some were unarmed, but the fact is, even in the unarmed circumstance, the individual was going for his weapon, thereby giving him that right to use his weapon to defend himself. These are all things which, to me, are academic. It shows clearly that he defended himself. But again, because of the narrative the left created right after the event, they are more focused on defending the narrative and undermining our constitutional rights than doing the right thing and admitting that Kyle was legally able to carry the weapon and defend himself legally.
And, you know, the other thing that's at play here, too, that can be precedent setting or maybe, you know, down a dangerous path, the next step down that dangerous path, is this idea that, well, you know, you may have some jurors say, well, we got to convict him on something so they don't burn down Kenosha. Yeah. We see the same thing going on in New York City where you had that Black Lives Matter activist Hank Newsom essentially threaten the incoming mayor of New York to say, you know, if you don't continue on with de Blasio's defund the police efforts, then there will be bloodshed. And if you don't have people standing up to people that are making threats of violence if they don't get their way, regardless of the rule of law, process or substance, then you will descend into sort of a Hobbesian state of nature.
I think it's true, Dan, that at the macro level and micro level, if you give in to threats of violence, you see large countries invading others if they show weakness. The same thing is at the micro, where if you have community leaders, and I'm being polite here, in New York, who are threatening the city and police with violence simply because they believe they should not be held accountable, then you will get more violence and you will get more acts of criminal behavior. That's what we've seen. So I think it's important the moment someone is threatened that you have people stand up. Kyle stood up. Kyle, I believe, showed great civic understanding and civic courage to try to defend the property and people of Kenosha. I think that was the right thing to do. And even now, when you're faced with it again, I think standing up to it is the only solution. If you give in, you will see more of the violence and you'll see more criminal behavior in any case. And I live right now in a place where law and order is recognized, appreciated. The community is multiracial. Everybody gets along very well. But the key is that everybody does understand that they are expected to live within the rule of law, no matter what that is.
Where is that community? People from Illinois are looking for communities.
Yeah, no, I actually live in North Carolina, in rural North Carolina.
There you go.
It's an amazing place by the fact that everybody works together to get along. That's community. And the moment you have these radical groups seeking to upend the order that people appreciate, law and order, you get the chaos. And therefore, you have to push back against the chaos very hard.
Well, our radical group is our Cook County State's Attorney. And I just wanted to tell you this story. We had a kid, a 17-year-old, stabbed an 18-year-old. The 17-year-old who stabbed him, the 18-year-old had his fist, didn't have a knife. There's video of it. And our Cook County State's Attorney said, oh, no, they were mutual combatants, so I'm not charging him. And there's video of him stabbing him, and the guy was unarmed. So she since changed her ways, but it took her 3 weeks to do it.
See, Amy, that's the thing. You cannot permit the official, I would say you put these radicals inside a government, you've got to double jeopardy them because you have activists on the outside, activists on the inside, undermining rule of law for all. And it's a very dangerous situation.
Going from the micro to the macro, since you mentioned it about weakness being provocative, the Biden administration's weakness certainly seems to be provoking. We see the reports of Iran redoubling its nuclear program. And also in Russia, Vlad Putin is on quite a run. He's got troops along Ukraine's borders. He's got his stooge in Belarus launching a refugee attack on NATO's eastern flank through Poland. And now, on Monday, Russia destroyed a defunct Soviet satellite with an anti-satellite missile, which, though apparently the United States was noticed on that, condemned it nonetheless, because if Jeff Bezos wants to move everybody off of Earth into some distant part of the Milky Way, then Russia's provocative actions in outer space could put a damper on that.
Yeah, I think we are, because of multiple administrations not paying attention, we are behind in space. And I did agree with President Trump's creation of Space Command. Some of our board members actually participated in President Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative and actually proposed that we get into space more quickly. We didn't do as well as we should. And now the Russians and China are both working to create dominance. And this is one of those things. I'm not for the militarization of space. I'm just for the fact that we have to have military capacity to defend our massive amounts of satellites and other things we've got in orbit. Yeah, this is what the left continues to fail to understand. It's like, even if you don't want us to militarize, others will and are. And to that point, Putin, by the way, Putin's also considering, according to the intelligence reports I've been reading, is considering grabbing more land, actually going more aggressively into Ukraine because, surprise, he sees the chaos in Afghanistan. He sees the chaos domestically. He believes that Joe Biden will not actually have the capacity to formulate an adequate response to his aggression. I think he's probably right, unfortunately. And China is doing the same thing. China makes open threats with no pushback. So if you see, this as a problem, that we are not in a position to actually defend our equities and what we want to do in space, you're probably correct, because at this point, from what I'm hearing, and by the way, I know Lloyd Austin, General Austin, when the Secretary of Defense, I worked for him when he was a Brigadier General. The Lloyd Austin I worked for then in Afghanistan is not the Lloyd Austin who's the Secretary of Defense now. And Mark Milley is a, I don't know how to describe Mark, and I know Mark. Both of them have, given up on trying to do the right thing to defend the country, and it shows. And I think
Well, that's a pretty big statement to say about the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They've given up on trying to protect the nation. That's a bit of a problem, it would seem.
Yes. Speaking of that, with Afghanistan, how many Americans are left? I mean, we had that sloppy, deadly exit out that we blame Biden for, but no one's talking about who's left there. Does anybody care?
Yeah, we do. So I can't go into a lot of details, Amy, because we are actually, as one of the center, working to help facilitate. I was actually on a call with one of the task forces attempting to do this. We think that most Americans are now out. We're probably at a level of probably at about 100 or so. There's been a number of things, Pineapple, and I'm helping directly another task force. And these are all special operations guys who served there. And those who have, like me, we all served there. We're trying to make sure that we can adequately fund and support this effort. We believe at this point, mostly those who are left are the green card holders and those who supported us who would be otherwise targeted and assassinated by the Taliban. So, and we're talking about probably about 3,000 to 5,000 of those. So I think most Americans are out. I can't verify that, but I think there's just a handful left. But obviously, we want to try to pull out those who actually supported us. What's ironic here is the Biden administration keeps talking about all the people they saved, and they have this canard of an effort. They keep putting up this effort saying they're doing it. I don't know of anybody in the administration actually doing anything. They've been more of a hindrance than anything else. But
Have you heard anything, reports about Americans, green card holders, legal permanent residents, or our allies, our Afghan allies, anybody being persecuted or killed at the hands of the Taliban?
So the answer is yes. And there's been some credible reports coming out. I don't have them right in front of me this minute, but there's been a number of instances where people are found, they're taken out, and bad things happen to them.
Including
the
American citizens?
The American media is not. The American citizens, no. This is okay. The interesting thing. The Taliban has been very careful to not attack a quote-unquote U.S. citizen by the fact that they've been able to manipulate the media to basically make the media dance to its own tune. They're a bit more sophisticated than the Taliban of 2001, and they do understand how to use the media better than ever. So they've been very careful to kind of only target Afghan citizens, Afghan nationals, especially those who served in the Afghan National Army and Afghan police. Those have been the two big targets, and I think they're going to continue to only focus on that as long as they believe they can get good media out of the West, which so far they are doing.
He is Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, retired. He's the president of the Herb London Center for Policy Research. He's the author of Operation Darkheart, Spycraft and Special Ops on the Front Lines of Afghanistan and the Path to Victory. Colonel Schaefer, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Thank you, Amy and Dan. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
You're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion. There's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. COVID isolation booths at your kid's school. Eastern Washington mom, Lexi Walsh, got a call from her son to come get her son from the Valley School District, Valley School in Stevens County, Washington State. But when she got there to pick up her six-year-old son, 6 years old,
okay,
he wasn't in the normal place. Here's the story.
Normally, when I've picked up my son for illness, he's been right in the front waiting for me.
Instead, this is where Lexi Walsh found her six-year-old Gabriel on Friday. In a room with other students, the school thought may have COVID. There was no teacher watching them, and the only door they could open from the inside led out to the road.
He told me that he was terrified and thought that he was put in jail for doing something wrong because they didn't tell him why he was in there.
The district says it placed six kids there in what they called their COVID isolation room, trying to separate symptomatic kids from everyone else. Gabriel told his teacher he had a stuffy nose, but he never tested positive for COVID.
There were periods of time where that staff member was not present.
Valley Superintendent Ben Fernie knows the district made some mistakes.
What we learned was we need to communicate better with our parents and with our internal staff when it comes to symptomatic students in isolation.
I tell you, it sounds like something Arnie Duncan would call a good start.
Yeah,
we're on
that's
the right,
right
track.
Yeah, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. What are we doing to our children?
So let me understand something. He had a stuffed nose, and so you throw him in the COVID isolation booth in a room with a door that opens from the inside, and this is a six-year-old, and it opens only into the road? It's funny because I posted this picture yesterday of a bunch of toddlers, you know, and the customary leash in which they're led around.
Oh, yeah.
In Chicago, crossing a street. They're all leashed up.
Oh, I see that every day of my life. I live right next to a daycare center. I can't take it anymore.
And they all had masks on, too,
right.
Outside.
That's the problem. Not
of
the leash,
they
the
did.
Masks.
But so you're going to leave a six-year-old unattended in a room with a door he can open from the inside that goes out to a road? While mom is en route to pick him up. Yeah, some mistakes were made, I'd say. Also this, he has a stuffed nose, throw him in the COVID isolation booth. Oh. Are we at a place yet where school districts, particularly with all the funny money that they've gotten dropshipped from the feds, could have the rapid tests on site to actually test the kid to see if he tests positive before he's thrown in the COVID isolation booth with the door that opens from the inside to the road?
I mean, they're trying to protect him, but yet they put his life in danger by putting him in that situation. I mean, no one is exercising common sense anymore, Dan. It has gone absolutely, everyone's, you know what, crazy.
Well, because if you are unvaccinated or if there's any indication that you have COVID, then, I mean, you're treated like you have the bubonic plague. You're treated like dirty. You're treated as the unclean. And, we're a couple of steps away from starting to burn people at the stake just out of an abundance of caution, it would seem to me.
And think about what's happening across our country. On Monday, Dan, guess what? Washington, D.C., no more indoor mask mandates for those. And so we're on an island. And if anybody's watching from our Matrix Home Solutions, I've got the picture of the map behind us. Now we're really on an island all our own.
Well, that's just wonderful.
Yeah. And then also yesterday, too, Dr. Awarde, somebody asked me to, you know, give her the idea about Arnie Duncan, because remember when he tweeted out that Austria is onto something when it comes to lockdowns of those 12 and older who are not vaccinated.
Right.
And they laughed at me. I'm sure you see what's going on in Austria. They're locking down people 12 and older who are not vaccinated. Arnie Duncan, the former CEO of CPS, said Austria is on to something in one of his tweets. Can you respond to that? Would that happen here?
So I feel like I should respond in German. I don't know. So
the whole room is laughing. Oh, so funny. But guess what? Yeah, it could happen. She didn't deny that it might not happen in Chicago.
I want to do everything we possibly can to not have to get into lockdown type situations. I don't anticipate it happening because of the vaccine, unless a new variant emerges and the vaccines don't work.
Sure. You always have to keep the option to lock down again open. You know what, though? I think you should take the good doctor Awardi up on her offer. I would like from now on, if she can, apparently she can, I would like from now on all her answers to be in German.
Sprachen Sie Deutsch?
Deborah in Arlington Heights, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Criminal what we are doing to these kids. Yep. And honestly, I think we need security cameras in schools and in daycare. I mean, my kids are grown, but when my son was in daycare, I remember I picked him up one time and he told me that Miss Whatever threw his blanket in the garbage. So I asked her about it and she said she did. He can't carry it around with him all day. And I'm like, that's not the answer, to throw it in the garbage. Like, you have to watch constantly what is going on, and what is going on is ruining our children.
Thanks for the call, Deborah. I mean, I just go back. One of the most despicable cases, that a special needs girl in Florida, we had her father on, where she, I think she has, she's autistic.
Yeah, she's autistic,
recall.
Yes.
And they were taping. Or tying with this lace
that on top of her head like a bow, then mask onto her face, and she was drooling. She could have drowned. I mean, there was drool in her mask, and she had this on for 6 hours a day, and she was masked. She had a medical exemption.
Medical exemption. They tied a mask to her face. It was only caught by mom and dad when she came home one day and got off the bus, and the mask was still tied to her face because that day they had forgotten to untie it. I mean, the barbarism associated with these COVIDians who think foolishly,
yep,
regardless of what you hear them say, that they can eliminate the virus, that they can stop the spread.
It's never going to happen. And right now, this morning, waking up, we have 4,000 plus. Think about it, 4,000 CPS kids who are healthy, who they are locked out of government-run schools because somebody in their class, and they have sort of a
good news, bad news proposition.
It's not. It's hard for their parents. It's hard for them. The kids want to be in school. They want to socialize. They don't want to be locked out again. And according to the CEO Martinez, just in case you care, the test to stay policy, he said yesterday, is going to go in effect the Monday after Christmas, so hopefully they'll do it.
Don in Bloomingdale.
You know, they treated this kid like he had leprosy. No one would want to get near this little guy to give him a test, Dan. They're so freaked out. My grandkids live out in St. Charles, and my daughter tells them every day, do not, unless you're puking or bleeding, go to the nurse for anything, because the whole house gets locked down if one of the kids is symptomatic.
Thanks for the call, Don. You know, one of the things, too, I mean, I would suggest if I were a parent, I would do this, even if I was sending my kid to a school that I trusted. I would bring them these stories, and I would just say to the principal, to his teachers, to the school board, let me tell you something. I'm not saying anybody's going to do it, but I'm seeing these stories from around the country, and if anybody does anything like they did to that little girl in Florida or this little boy in Eastern Washington, if anybody thinks to do anything like that to my kid, then, you know, in the immortal words of Clint Eastwood, I'm coming and hell's coming. Well, actually, that's not Clint Eastwood. That's Tombstone. I'm coming and hell's coming with me.
Yep.
I think you need to be proactive on this, because you just, all it takes is, you know, a couple of doofuses that are in front of a class or a doofus superintendent or principal. And, you know, this sort of stuff can happen to your kid, and you should try to prevent it. Pedro on the Northwest side.
Hey, so a kid in my kid's CPS school had COVID. Everyone had a quarantine. Well, that kid was vaccinated previously. So now he actually went back to school before the unvaccinated kid.
Right.
And one of the problems, too, is, and I don't know if you covered this, was if a CPS student comes out with COVID, they're not allowed to play sports for 90 days after. That's an entire season.
Wait, what? I've never heard that before.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, my kids both had COVID, and they came back after 10 days. They came back before the rest of the team could.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. But they're still carrying the virus. It's
Wait a second. Wait, Pedro. On that 90-day, is that happening at your kid's school?
Yes.
90 days.
What school is it?
I'll shoot you a copy of, I don't want to say it out loud,
that's
but
fine.
I'll shoot you something on Twitter.
Yeah, please do.
One quick thing. We sort of associated with this. We really got to keep an eye on that Arne Duncan. I think he already has a team in place to run for mayor.
Oh, yeah, he does.
And after that Austria statement, that's terrifying.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Pedro.
Well, also, too, if you don't get vaccinated, you're just like the Taliban. Remember that tweet he had, too? I mean, he is out progressiving himself every single day.
Mm-hmm. He should stick to rebounding for Obama. Mike in Elmhurst.
Hey, what's going on, guys? How you doing? My daughter, she's 4 years old. She's school. And yesterday they had like a little Thanksgiving meal. They let them eat soup and crackers. And they took their masks off for the first time of the entirety time that they've been at preschool. And my daughter comes home and she tells me, I saw my friend's faces for the first time. It was weird. She didn't like the fact that they looked different. And it scared her. This is ruining these kids at such a young age. My four-year-old daughter doesn't like looking at other people's faces and thinks that it's weird. Can you believe that?
That's a very interesting observation. Oh, thanks, Mike.
We got a text message. There's still middle schools here that aren't allowing parents or fans into girls' volleyball games and basketball games. And by the way, volleyball and basketball still have to wear masks. But if you go to a college game, the Wisconsin Northwestern game everyone went to, no mask there at the collegiate level for men and women's sports. Then why do we have to do it at the high school level and the middle school level?
That's the Pfizer generation. Chuck and Delavan.
Hey, I was little Jimmy Finch was in my third grade class. He always had boogers coming out of his nose. Hey, the reason I called you was that deal about that door. That's like against fire codes. You can't do that. You have to have all doors open. You can't do that. And my other question is, what about the other five children that were in there? Where are their parents? Did they come forward and say something, too, for having their kids locked down? This is getting insane. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Chuck. Maybe Jimmy Finch should keep his mask on, the kid with the boogers, but that's it. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.